Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. We believe small actions can have great impact. Take a small action today. Speak to a financial broker about a Zurich pension.
Neil, thank you very much for that. Now, she has been struggling with an eating disorder every day for the past 12 years, but one young Irish woman still can't access an inpatient bed or the support of a dietitian, perhaps because in the whole country there are only 3 dedicated inpatient beds for adults with eating disorders. Lisa Murphy tells her story in the current issue of the Echo newspaper, and to tell us how the situation has affected her, I also spoke to her earlier today. Just a warning that, as you would expect, this interview might be upsetting or triggering for some listeners. Now, Lisa began by telling me when she first realised that something wasn't right.
I suppose, you know, all through childhood I had a very kind of unhealthy relationship with food. I would hide food and, you know, eat in private and things. And as a child, I didn't really understand why I was doing that, but I just knew it brought me a lot of joy. But it didn't really morph into an eating disorder until I went to college. Like, I'd done a lot of the crash dieting and things in school. But when I went to college, I just started binge eating. And then one day I just had the idea to vomit or purge. I think about that day often, and never in a million years did I think it would be what it is today, like morph into what it is, like just on the back of that one thing I did way back when, you know.
Mm. How long ago was that then that it started?
That was about 12 years ago, and in kind of the year building up to when the bulimia started, there was a lot of kind of over-exercising, crash dieting, that kind of stuff that's kind of typical of an eating disorder and development, really. And then I was 19 when I started the purging and the laxative abuse.
Okay, so it was, as you say, it was sort of building up to that point well before that. And of course, you know, there's when we talk about eating disorders now, there's a lot of focus on social media and Instagram and Facebook and all the pressures that can come from that. But I suspect then maybe if it was 12 years ago or even before that, that wasn't as much of an influence or a problem.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, kind of Facebook was really only taking off. So it didn't really influence the development of it, but it certainly is a maintaining factor, and it has definitely contributed to the progression of it. Mm. You know, just seeing different images online and thinking I look this that way, the other, and feeling that I have to look a certain way in an image. And so it's definitely a driving force behind how severe it is. Absolutely.
So can you talk us through then, Lisa, what a typical day is like for you?
It always starts the same. I kind of would get up, but I'd be exhausted because I, you know, in the middle of the night, a lot of it happens in the middle of the night as well. So I generally don't sleep that much. So I'd get up, and it's usually when I'm really in the thick of bulimia, because I can go into anorexic behaviours as well. But when I'm entrenched in bulimia, I would get up and, you know, try not to eat anything. And I would, you know, kind of berate myself a lot and call myself a lot of names and weigh myself and kind of judge what I'm looking at and the whole lot. And I'd usually last then until about 11-ish, maybe 12. Sometimes I can push it out a bit further without eating. But once I start eating, it honestly is like this compulsion just comes over me, and it's very frantic, and I'm running around from shop to shop and takeaways, McDonald's, Burger King, those kinds of places, and just essentially eating until I can't really breathe. I'm so full of food and my stomach is protruding. It's because it's just so full, and it's very painful. And I would usually then kind of vomit in public toilets. I would try and go back to work, but I wouldn't last too long before it starts again. And when I'm taking laxatives, I'm vomiting into bags if, you know, I run out of different places to actually vomit if I'm at home, for example. Between the vomiting and the laxative abuse, you know, it's a very painful disorder. So I'm in a lot of pain. You know, I get chest pain as well, just from the strain of vomiting that much. Like, it can be quite violent, actually. And I'm usually at some point of the day crying, just crying my eyes out, just like I don't really believe in God or anything. I'm not very religious, but I'm just asking, like, anything, anyone up there, like, if I can just stop this, and if I can just get a bit of relief. But it's just relentless. And then sometimes I'll be, you know, I'll try to, you know, I'll either try and get into the bed just to stop, or find some way of distracting myself, try and work or respond to emails or ring, you know, have work meetings or whatever. But it just always kind of creeps back in. And when I feel it, that compulsion coming over me again, I'm generally kind of asking myself to stop. I'm kind of pleading with myself because it genuinely feels like I'm not in control of my own behaviour or my own actions. So I'm kind of asking myself to stop then and crying to myself, but it just feels like I'm not in control of my own body or what I'm doing to it at all.
And yeah. And when you say that when you wake up you haven't had much sleep, mm-hmm. are you purging during the night then as well, or what's happening at night time?
Yeah, so usually I would buy a lot of food every day. So, you know, I'll buy enough food to kind of last me into the night, so I could sometimes be there till kind of 1-2 in the morning. I might kind of pass out at around 11 o'clock and then wake up at 3 or 4 and pick up where I left off, and just be binging and purging in the middle of the night. And then, like, sometimes I'd say my poor housemates think we have a ghost in the house. Like, sometimes if I run out of food then and I have no other options, I'll take theirs. And it's this compulsion to eat and get sick and eat and get sick and eat and get sick, and it just seems relentless, really.
And when you say that's your daily existence, I mean, is that every day?
You know, typically, yeah, like on just any old given day, yeah, unless, you know, there's something out of the ordinary happening, for example, or, you know, at Christmas there now, if there are kind of dinners or things like that, you know, I'd go out and I would just do the same when I'm out. I would be going into the public toilet wherever I am, getting sick in there, and then coming out and saying to people, you know, I'm actually still really hungry, I'm going to get more food, and I just can't stop. And I'll generally leave, like, if I have to go to an event or something, I'll leave early, or I'll just keep to myself for the day and go around looking for food and getting sick wherever I can.
So when you wake up in the morning then, you know, having had, as you say, a really difficult night generally, mm-hmm. like, what's going through your head, Lisa, when you know that that's ahead of you every day? I can't even imagine.
Genuinely, like, most days when I wake up, like, firstly, it's just the exhaustion. Like, it's difficult to actually get myself to sit up and get out of the bed. I'd be thinking to myself, like, I can't believe I have to go through this again today. Like, I can't believe I have to do this again. And I think people might be a bit confused by that, because to hear, like, that I have to do it, you know, there's no one standing over me with a gun to my head, you know, telling me I have to do these things. But I'm not in control of it, so it does feel like it's happening to me.
But you are doing it and you're holding down a job?
Somehow, yeah. Like, so there are up and down periods in my, or quiet and busy periods in my job. When they're very busy, I literally, anytime I'm not binging and purging, I'll be, whether or not, if it's in, it could be in the middle of the night, it could be literally any time, I'll try and just get stuck into work. Because I go into kind of periods of anorexia where I'm not eating anything, so I'm not purging, I'm not doing any of that, I have so much time on my hands that I'll just throw myself into work and I'll get kind of nearly too much done, you know. So it's a very chaotic, I have periods of very, very high productivity if I'm not really eating that much, and then periods of no productivity at all when I'm totally out of control with the bulimia. So it's not, there's no routine really, I suppose.
You mentioned your housemates thinking there was a ghost in the house. Do they know, or did they know, or who knows?
So my housemates at the moment, I'd say they absolutely had an idea there was something very wrong, but we hadn't talked about it. But they obviously know now and they're very supportive. Mm. But up and before today, like, because I suppose the past year has been extremely, you know, traumatic. I think, I'm not saying lockdown and the pandemic caused my problems, but it absolutely took, I suppose, how low I was to a new level. So I had a suicide attempt last March, and kind of since then, most of the close people in my life would know what's going on, even though they feel very helpless. They can't really help, you know, in the ways that they want. But most of my kind of close family and friends would have known from what happened last March what's going on.
Can you tell me then what you've done to try and get help over the last 12 years?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I first kind of started to really develop the eating disorder, you know, my parents paid for private therapy sessions. I, over the years myself, you know, I've availed, when I was in college, I went to the counselling there and things. And, you know, I've gone to PA to house counselling, all that. I've done all that kind of stuff. And with the public service, what it's I'm in a bit of a cycle with them. So what tends to happen is I'll either end up in A&E or, you know, something will happen that will get me referred into wherever catchment area I'm living, referred into the public mental health services there. You're generally waiting like anywhere from a few weeks to a few months to an assessment with the consultant psychiatrist in the catchment area. And then once you have your assessment, they'll put you on a waiting list for a particular type of therapy that you're usually on that for months. And what happens is, like, I'd engage in that. I would go with the best intentions. And usually, you know, when it's an hour a week, I find it very difficult to engage when I'm, let's say, sitting in the waiting room and eating, getting sick, and then going in, trying to engage in an hour of therapy and then coming out and just picking up where I left off. It was not really sufficient for what I need. So that tends to be the cycle. And then I would tend to disengage, and then I would feel obviously awful about disengaging because I would think, you know, God, if there's even a bit of help there, like, take it. But it just was very difficult to try and get better when it was kind of 50 minutes to an hour a week or every second week sometimes. And I felt totally out of control. So I've asked them for many times over the years to help me get into a facility, but I was either told we don't do that, like the HSE don't refer people at all, or we don't do it anymore, or it's not an option, or, you know, I've been told definitively no many times.
Because there's only 3 beds in the whole country.
Yeah.
Inpatient.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's it.
For eating disorders. I know that you spoke anonymously to the Echo in Cork on a number of occasions trying to get attention onto this need for inpatient treatment, and your case was also raised in the Dáil anonymously. You obviously didn't want to come out publicly. This is such a private issue that you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. But then you decided to do that. Why did you decide to put your face to your own story?
I've lived with this now for so long, and I know me very well, and I know what I respond to, and I know what might give me a chance. And that to me is, you know, in the residential centre that I'm in contact with, it's a very warm, lovely place. It's a big house as opposed to a clinical hospital, and there are professional nurses and psychologists and therapists and psychiatrists there 24/7, and they support you to learn, you know, how to eat, how to, you know, not purge, how to get, you know, and it's a very safe and kind of controlled environment. And I think that's the best shot that I have, because I've tried over the years to control it myself, and I just can't. So I think, I don't know if it'll work, to be honest. I've heard good things from people in this centre when they've come out, but I don't know if it will work. I just have to try, really, because I don't think I can do this for much longer, like live like this for much longer, really. It's really excruciating.
And what's the other option if that doesn't work? I mean, if you don't get into the inpatient facility?
I really don't know, to be honest. Do you know, I've been a year on the waiting list now with the mental health team that is in my catchment area, and they've offered me 20 sessions of therapy. And that's kind of, again, an hour a week with a psychologist. There's no kind of dietitian support in that or anything like that. So I, you know, I'll take that. To be honest, though, I would... Just for myself, I would worry if I can't access this treatment. I'm doing this as an absolute last resort. I've resisted it for so long because I didn't want to do it. But I think I'm out of options in terms of just my actual chances of living a long life. And I have to just try.
Mm. How are you coping today, Lisa, after making the decision to put it out there then?
Like this morning, I was a bit sick, to be honest. But like, I've stayed in my friend's house now, and the two of us are just here all day. Like, she's been so supportive, and all my friends are and family are on to me. Oh, like the whole day they've been on to me, and you know, strangers have been on to me. And I think I didn't really anticipate how much that would help. Just people saying kind words, but I'm just clinging on to that today. Like, that's more so than monitoring the GoFundMe. I'm just kind of really hanging on to. Onto people, and that's kind of what's getting me through. And just feeling that support from my friends and family is really amazing. And to be honest, I do feel a bit relieved, Sarah, because it's been such a secret life for so long. And I'm like, you know what? Now people know what I'm doing, and there is a bit of freedom in that as well. because, as I said, it gets very lonely, like.
Yeah, because it's so interesting and heartbreaking, really, to hear you talk about it, Lisa, to say that, you know, that you have this support system there, that, you know, your family and friends are there urging you on. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine how difficult it is for them as well to want to help and not knowing how to help. And even today, listening to you talk to us and talk about where you're at and what a dark place it is.
Yeah.
You know, it's so difficult.
Yeah, like, there are get-togethers there and things like that with friends and family, and I'm always the one stuck in the toilet or eating so much that I can't even listen to what they're saying to me, you know, or leaving things early because I can't control my eating. I know they're there and I love them so much and they're brilliant, but I miss out on a lot of time with them just because I'm so preoccupied with what I'm doing.
So there are only 3, as I mentioned, dedicated inpatient mm-hmm. beds for adults with eating disorders. I think all of those are in St. Vincent's in Dublin. There are treatments in general hospitals or psychiatric hospitals for patients as well. But in terms of the dedicated eating disorder beds, there's only 3 of them. What would your message be to people running the mental health services and who decide how much funding they have to get, that you find yourself in this situation where you have to publicly tell your story to try and get money to fund your own treatment?
Yeah, I think, you know, Sarah, on one hand, I can, like, Ireland in particular, we have a very long history of treating people with mental illness appallingly, like institutionalizing people, locking them away, kind of taking them out of the community. And I absolutely understand the drive for community-based care. That's kind of the movement at the moment. So I really appreciate that, and I appreciate why we want to keep people in the community as opposed to going into residential programs or residential facilities. What I would say is that I think it should be case by case, and I think people who get to a point where I'm at, where I can barely function on a day to day with what I'm doing to my body, it should be the case that the space is there for people like that, that need that just extra level, that a bit more intense care, a bit more support. And it shouldn't get to that extent, but it should be an option. And it shouldn't be just a blanket. We want to keep people in the community, no matter how serious you are.
Okay. Well, I think you've done a really brilliant job, Lisa, of just outlining what you need, what help you need. And I really do hope that you get that help. The last time I looked at the GoFundMe page, you were at €23,000 already raised, and you need to get
phenomenal.
To 60. So
there's a long way to go. So anyone that has any small amount, I'd really, really appreciate it.
Well, that was Lisa Murphy speaking to me a little earlier on this afternoon. And if you've been affected by any of the issues raised in that interview, you can find details about supports at rte.ie/helplines. Now, a little earlier on the programme, we heard from Irish woman Lisa Murphy, who has been struggling with an eating disorder for over a decade, and she laid out her story very eloquently on the programme just after 5 o'clock. But how widespread is that condition, and how has the pandemic in particular affected the demand for services? Well, to discuss this, we're joined now by one of those who are treating eating disorders on the front line, and that's Professor Cathy McHugh, who is a consultant physician in Sligo University Hospital. And thank you very much, Professor, for joining us on the programme this evening.
You're very welcome.
As I say, Lisa Murphy laid out her story very, very well. It was very difficult to listen to, but important to hear at the same time, I think. How typical is her situation and the problems that she's facing?
Well, to be honest now, I was on the ward, so I didn't hear her story, but I heard it briefly beforehand. Mm. I would say from our experience in Sligo at the moment, we would normally take in to the hospital about 4 to 5, maybe 6 eating disorder patients per year, which would be at the very extreme malnourished spectrum. So far this year, we've taken in 12, and we have 3 on the wards as we speak. So there's been an absolute explosion, and we are just getting, in the hospital, we're getting the tip of the iceberg. When I speak to my colleagues in the community, it has blown out of all control at the moment. Now, why the pandemic has been so detrimental to it is a good question. Mm-hmm. It would appear on the front line, certainly what's happened is that the whole anxiety level of the whole country has been raised. And these are a very vulnerable subset of society who are vulnerable to anxiety. And then all their social supports have been stripped away. They're isolated from their families, from work, which is a very levelling experience for every one of us. And we all need to go, you know, to go to work and be seen to go to work. And that helps a lot with these kind of disorders. The psychiatric services were suspended. They were doing phone consultations. And if you're looking for someone to self-report weight, in this instance, you're not, it doesn't work. So, and you then get people who are at home and totally focused on their eating disorders and the control of it when the whole country is out of control. What they can control is their eating disorders, and they're at home on their own, and they are obsessing about their calorie intake, their exercise output. And they're such a vulnerable group of people that though that perfect storm has tipped so many of them over, and the anxiety level, it's been noticeable. It's been a huge outburst in the community itself, and then we're getting the severe end of it in here. And I have significant concerns about bringing people into a hospital environment in the middle of a pandemic. And they're very vulnerable if these people get COVID. So I'm trying to keep as many of them in the community as I can. But if they get to a serious level, then I just have to take them in. You know, it's better to be in here and fed than out there and malnourished.
Is it possible to provide services over the phone if necessary, or how does that work?
It is to a level. You can, if you're at a good level, you can keep it at a level. And it very much depends on the person, because it's a very individual thing. And someone who's in a good place or feels they're slipping can ring our services and or ring the psychiatric services and maintain that. But if you've actually pitched down beyond that level, then you need a one-to-one support. You need to come in. You need to see somebody. I need to see you. I need to see what weight you're at. And certainly from the very physical end of it that I would see, they need to manage in a hospital. When you get to very low BMIs, we need to do it in a very controlled hospital environment. It's very hard to do any medical consultation on a phone if it's about anything. And if you're looking for the psychiatric, psychological type of things, without that face-to-face consultation, really it's frivolous. And it has gone out of control.
Yeah, I know you didn't hear all of Lisa's interview, but one of the things that she was saying is, and you know, she's looked for supports throughout the last 12 years as she has been suffering from the eating disorder. And one of the options available to her was therapy for an hour every week or an hour every 2 weeks. But she was saying it just wasn't or hasn't landed for her, you know, that she'd be in the waiting room and she'd be binging and purging in the waiting room beforehand, and then she'd go in for her hour, and then afterwards she'd go on to binge and purge afterwards, you know, and it just felt like it wasn't making any difference at all.
My God, help her. Some people would be, it depends on the person. Some can be managed on that kind of basis. But in general, if you have an eating disorder in Ireland, there is little to nothing out there to support you. And the GPs are crying out, because that's the normal port of call for a lot of people. What do you go to your GP? What does your GP do? Because there's no next step. There's very, very minimal services. We have some in Sligo. We're very lucky. We have a fabulous eating disorder nurse. But we can only look after the Sligo Leitrim area. We can't do the country. And there are very few of her in the country. When she gets involved in someone who's in extreme trouble, she could ring them every day. She would ring them 5-6 times a day. She would call out to them. She would get them in to see her every day. It's a huge emotional support. And it's not something that can be done on a dip-in, dip-out basis. And the other thing about this is that a lot of people won't express it and don't feel they have a problem when they really do have a problem. So they don't necessarily approach the services to look for it. So it's very, very difficult on all those levels.
So if you were the Minister for Health, or if you had a magic wand that you could wave to try and start improving the services that are there for people, as you say, more and more people that you're seeing now as a result of the pandemic, what would be the top two steps, do you think, Cathy, that could be taken now?
I think if you're a patient, what you need is an eating disorder nurse dedicated to you and to your disorder, a psychiatrically trained eating disorder nurse. And that is the difference between you doing well and you doing poorly. She or he, maybe I shouldn't be genderist about it, will offer personal support, will do family therapy, and is in a position to do it, to do significant input as needed. So I think that is a number one. The other thing that
you don't happen to know, sorry to put you on the spot, but you don't happen to know how many of those nurses we have in the country, do you?
Or? No, I don't know. No. As far as I know, there's only about four or five at the most, if even. I know we have one here, and there is. I don't know if it's even that number, to be honest. We've only got a dietitian this week, and to manage a disorder that is it's not a primary food disorder, but it's manifested through food, without dietetic support is, it's like driving your car without wheels. It is not going to happen.
And so you just got a dietitian this week?
This week. And we've been running an eating disorder service for a number of years now. And that's our outpatient. We use the inpatient dietetic services who are already overstretched. But for an outpatient service, which is where 99.9% of these people are managed and should be managed, because you need this disorder when you're at home. No, I can patch it up. It's like you an alcoholic stopping drinking in the hospital. When you go home, you need to be able to manage it at home. So most of it should be managed at home in the community with a lot of support in the community. I would say that an eating disorder nurse is the single biggest thing that's needed. There are inpatient beds. Certainly, there's no doubt about that. But the vast majority are needed would be in the community.
And just on the issue of inpatient beds, the mental health plan that was published in 2018 was due to be completed. It was due to be completed in a 5-year period. It was due to deliver 16 promised specialist treatment hubs that would offer multidisciplinary teams of clinicians. It has only delivered 3 of those multidisciplinary teams of clinicians. How important an aspect is that in it, do you think?
Very important. It's very sporadic throughout the country. If you draw a line from Sligo to Dublin, or from Galway to Dublin, there's nothing north of there except us, and we have had absolutely £0 and zero pence in our service. We do it purely on not a voluntary basis. We do it outside, in addition to our normal work. You need this delivered locally. You need to support it at those levels. And what you don't want to do is bring these people out of their family community, if you can at all, or away from home. If you even put them in a hospital, in Dublin, all of a sudden the family are in Sligo and they can't visit, and the family are what gets you through and keeps you out of this. They are your biggest support in the whole world. So I think it needs to be locally delivered with that level of expertise. Now, there are some training courses going on, and I know we've been involved in a lot of training to try and upskill psychiatric people around the country, because that's all we can do, because we're not getting anyone else. We just try and upskill people who are interested so that they can then, they use us as a phone consultation service. But the only way we can get this out there, short of dividing ourselves into 100 pieces, is to upskill as many people who are existing out there. But they're getting very little support in terms of hours or training other than ours. So it's not rocket science. You just need a few dedicated people in the right spots with the right skills. And it can certainly be done. It's not anything fancy or high tech.
Well, we did ask to speak to the Minister of State at the Department of Health with responsibility for mental health and older people, Mary Butler, but she wasn't available to speak to us this evening. We may return to this topic if she is available on another day, because as you've outlined there, Cathy, some relatively simple things that could be done that would make a big difference. So we might find out why they're not being done and when they will be done. But thank you very much for joining us this evening. That's Professor Cathy McHugh, who is a consultant physician in Sligo University Hospital. We'll take a break.